she got into economics because she told me that she got in, under the influence of Schrapper from the early beginnings, and she's still at it, and I think she's still at it very effectively, so we are very happy to have her here today. I would also like to bring your attention to other one more thing is...
That's not a very difficult task because, as it turns out, John Robinson is familiar to almost everybody who has the biggest understanding or connection with or familiarity with economics and the development of economics. I think that of all existing economists, she has perhaps been the singular figure who has served at the forefront of every major revolution in economic thought in this century, beginning with the revolution in the theory of imperfect competition, and going through the Keynesian revolution, in which she herself played a major part, not only in formulating the initial ideas of Keynes, but in developing it and advancing it beyond the point at which Keynes left off. In addition, after the Keynesian revolution, the whole confrontation and controversy over the theory of capital, she played a major part in defining the issue and in formulating some of the approaches to that problem. And finally, in the theory of growth and development, she has also played a major and important role. So for all of these reasons, I don't think it is necessary for me to mention in any detail who or what Mrs. Robinson is. She's now, I might just add, Professor Emeritus at Cambridge University and visiting us for about 10 days, in the course of which she's been having discussions with people here, and this is the origin then of today's talk. In closing, let me just mention one big point, which is, for those of you who are not yet familiar with it, I would strongly recommend that you have a look at her most recent book, written jointly with Johnny Bell, called Modern Economics. It should be in the bookstore. If it isn't, then get some additional copies soon. So without further ado, I will introduce Mrs. Robinson.
Restore the old doctrines which were the expression of the presumption in favour of laissez-faire. It's this deep-seated confusion in the heart of the system which accounts for its logical inconsistency. I know for some of you, Keynes is a bad word. So when I say restoring the pre-Keynesian system, you can interpret it as being pre-Keynesian system. Of the analytical ideas, which were derived by Keynes, are exactly the same as those of Keynes, though the political angle and the ideological implications were different. Now, when Keynes came to look back after the general theories published, after the discussion had been going on for some time, look back to say what was the central difference between his theory and the theory that he was displacing. And this is in the article which was published in the QJ in 1937, in the answer to Byron's review, where he says, once you acknowledge the fact that the future is uncertain, then the whole structure of orthodox theory falls to the ground. The decisions which are being taken by everybody who is concerned with economic life are always being taken in the light of some kind of best guess of what is going to happen, or in the light of, or under the influence of conventional behavior, conventions about what is the correct or proven way to behave. Now, if everybody are taking their decisions in this way, they won't converge onto an equilibrium when the decisions are carried out. This seems to be a very obvious fact once we think about it. Keynes says that the kind of uncertainty which surrounds economic and political life cannot be reduced to terms of mathematical probability. That the idea of calculating risk is the idea, is one of the pretty polite techniques which tries to deal with the present by abstracting from the fact that we know very little about the future. What is this concept of equilibrium which is at the heart of orthodox economics? Equilibrium has been defined in these terms. Prices and input-output combinations are said to be equilibrium prices and input-output combinations if, when they move, no economic agent has any inducement to change his method of production and no input or output is in excess of the norm. Are we all right for some? Can you hear all right? You'd like me to speak louder? Well, I'll repeat the definition of equilibrium. Prices and input-output combinations are said to be equilibrium prices and input-output combinations if, when they rule, no economic agent has any inducement to change its method of production and no input or output is in excess of demand. This entails that everyone concerned in the economy has complete, full knowledge of what are the consequences of any action that he takes. How can he say that his product methods are the best unless he knows precisely what would be the consequences of any change that he was to make? In fact, when they're trying to set up models for dealing with these problems, they very often introduce the assumption of correct foresight. Everybody has correct foresight. Not only what he's going to do himself over the next future, but also what the market is going to do. Everybody has correct foresight. Well, if you have to resort to the assumption of correct foresight in order to set up your model isn't going to be of any interest. There's another curious feature of this conception of equilibrium. It's said to be the end of an economic process. You start in an arbitrary position, and then by trading and retrading, you reach an equilibrium position. Now, what was it about the past period the economy has been living through which led it into a disequilibrium position? And why is the future going to be any different? Why you've lived through a past which did not get to equilibrium, but now in the next future you are going to get to equilibrium? This seems to me to be a very strange notion. Now, furthermore, the concept of stability, which is used in economics, is based on a mechanical analogy which is not appropriate to economic problems. The analogy of the pendulum swinging of weights in a scale and so on. Now, in all these mechanical relationships, you can go to and fro. You put weights into one scale, put some more weight into one scale, it'll go down and take them out again to go up. The movement in time is not of that nature. Movement in time is always going from the past into the future. And any change is bound to alter the expectations, and therefore the decisions, of the people who are involved. Now, this notion of a movement into equilibrium being of the same nature, susceptible to the same mathematical treatment, as a movement following a change after you've been in equilibrium, or after you've been in any particular position, is quite false. And the whole methodology of equilibrium theory is completely at fault. I said, some theorists, even among those who reject general equilibrium as totally useless, praise its logical elegance and completeness. Now, a system of simultaneous equations need not specify any date, nor does its solution involve history. But if any proposition drawn from it is applied to an economy inhabited by human beings, it immediately becomes self-contradictory. Human life does not exist outside time. No one has correct foresight of his own future behavior, let alone of the behavior of all the other individuals who will impinge upon his. I do not think it is right to praise the logical elegance of a system which becomes self-contradictory when it is applied to the question that it was designed to answer. I think you can contrast this concept of equilibrium with the concept which we find in von Neumann and in Srauch. Their systems operate in logical time, not in historical time. The specification of the position at any moment entails its past as well as its future. So that the question cannot be asked, is this a stable system or an unstable system? The question is completely meaningless, because the system can't do anything but play out the consequences of the situation which exists. And if you were to confront it with the question, what would happen if there were a change? You have to bring in a whole new analysis to explain what happens when the system is off the path, off the rail, or when there's a change in the composition of output, change in demand, change in technology. You're going to throw your system into an out of equilibrium short period position, and then you've got to introduce a whole story about how it reacts. The story which Srauch or von Neumann gives you won't tell you anything about that. It's not designed to tell you anything about it. It's describing a process in logical time and not in historical time. Now, the obvious application of the Keynesian Revolution or Paletskian Revolution is to those problems which are treated under the head of macroeconomics, investment, growth, rate of interest, and so on. But I think that microeconomics, what is taught under the heading of microeconomics, needs to Keynes and revolution just as much, because it's based on this completely self-contradictory concept of reaching equilibrium. Now this should be thrown away, and we should approach the problems of prices, markets and so on in the same historical sense, bringing in the relation between expectations and behavior as is required for the problems of the trade cycle in which the argument was originally deployed. What is the Barrasian general equilibrium? As far as I understand it, you have a number of individuals, and each one has an endowment of some factor of production. The carpenter has the possibility of doing the services of carpentry. Blast furnace has the possibility of doing the services of producing iron and so on. Now, everybody has some property, either in his own capacity or in some means of production, some piece of land, whatever it may be. Here are these people, they're a list of people. And there's a list of known commodities, and the people have tastes for these commodities, and then the list of means of production provides you with a production possibility surface for producing these specified commodities. Now the prices of the commodities are determined by supply and demand in the market. From the prices you derive the higher prices of the factors of production. From the higher prices of the factors and the list of endowments, you derive the incomes, and the incomes are spent on commodities, and so you have a complete circle of simultaneous equations. But there's a weak point in this circle, you see, between the prices and the incomes, because you can't say anything about what determines the incomes, except in a census. You say, Mr. Snoops is a carpenter, and in the equilibrium position, the wage of power price of a carpenter is so much per hour, and he has the capacity for doing 40 hours a week carpentry, you see. Mr. Jones owns the blast furnace, and the blast furnace has the capacity of producing so much iron, the higher price of a blast furnace is so much. Mr. Smith has 6 blast furnaces, so he has 6 times the income of Mr. Jones, and so on. You simply have to have a census showing how the income is distributed amongst the people according to their endowments and according to the prices of the services of the endowments which have derived from demand. So you can't really say anything about how demand is affected, or you can only give an ad hoc description of how demand is affected by prices in the system. Now, the supporters of general equilibrium often say that general equilibrium does permit you to discuss the effect of demand. And the Zrafa system leaves out demand. This is very frequently said. The argument was put forward in a paper by Professor Johnson. I don't know if you've seen, there's some lectures which he gave a year or two ago in Finland. Anyway, he puts forward, I think, a very useful simplification of the task. He reduces the whole thing to a two-commodity, two-factor model. And the two factors consist of uniform labor, number of workers, all exactly alike, and a lump of putty capital, which can be capital goods, which can be squeezed up into various forms to produce different commodities with different techniques. Now, you know, this thing of putty capital was introduced into the debate about accumulation. And in the context of accumulation, putty or jelly or ectoplasm or leaks, whatever it's called by a number of names, I could never shame them. I could never say, well, look here, you're assuming that capital goods are made of ectoplasm. All right, we'll make them up of an ectoplasm. You could never get past their... you could never get past them in this way by exposing the hollowness of what they were doing. But in that context, the concept of putty capital was in order to do away with the difference between the past and the future. Because the essential feature thing is that capital goods are malleable. You have a certain amount of putty, you invest it in one form, then demand changes or technique changes, and you can squeeze up the same quantity of capital and turn it into a completely different set of machines, equipment, and stocks without extra cost. So the point has nothing to do with capital. I mean, nobody could think anything so absurd had anything to do with capital. But it has to do with the problem of time, the problem that you can't get into equilibrium if you're moving through a world in which change takes place. Unexpected change takes place. There are never going to be any losses, because you can always squeeze your capital up into a new form without cost. Now, in that context, it's simply a device for getting away from the basic problem of the nature of historical time. But as Johnston uses it, I think it's quite acceptable, because in any case, your Valrhesian system is outside time. It's a timeless equilibrium. And these inputs have to be substitutable with each other. You have to put into the specification of the Valrhesian model, first of all, that these factors, these inputs, are versatile and can be used in different combinations for different commodities, so that it's possible to get a position where all the factors are being used to produce these specified commodities. And you furthermore have to assume that when you've gone through the process of finding the prices, the list of inputs, everybody has got an income which permits him to live. Because otherwise, some of the people that the story started with will have dropped down dead because they couldn't get enough input. And therefore, the new position of equilibrium will contain less people than the old one. So you have to put in these special assumptions to make it work. Well, those special assumptions can be represented by putting all the physical inputs together as putty and assuming an isoquant in putty and labor, and the isoquant never cuts the axis and never falls. The isoquant on the labor axis never falls so low that somebody can't live. Well, right, then let's have this. This way of presenting Valrhesian model enables you to say something about the relation between demand and distribution. Gets over this problem of having had census. So, for instance, you could make a number of propositions. You could say, if the owners of putty have a strong preference for the more putty-intensive commodity, then their price of the putty-intensive commodity will be high enough to make their income high enough to enable them to buy it. Now, if the workers also prefer the putty-intensive commodity, then they'll be in a worse position because they're raising the price of the commodity that they prefer. But if the workers preferred the more labor-intensive commodity, then they would have a higher income, higher level of consumption than if they didn't. So you can make a whole lot of propositions like this. It'd take you quite fun to make them up. And then you can find the relations between tastes and income. We've got this very simple production cost quantity surface, two commodities. We can draw it as a... And then you put a point on it, and at this point, you've got determinate prices, distribution, and tastes enter into the determination of the distribution and the equilibrium. So, This is then very similar to a SRAPA position. And in SRAPA system, you've got a particular input-output table. You've got a particular rate of profit, which determines all the prices, and a particular composition of output. And presumably, the prices and incomes are such that the people can live with this composition of output. You have a higher rate of profit, you have a different system in which there'd be more steel and more caviar in the composition of output, and a higher wage rate, the lower rate of profit, there'll be more bread and wheat in the composition of output. So you can play the same game with the SRAPA model. The only difference is that in the Bayesian thing, the inputs are just an arbitrary job lot, just this particular number, but it happens to exist for some reason. Whereas in SRAPA, all the inputs are reproducing themselves and have come into existence by a process of investment in the expectation of a particular composition of output that in fact is being produced. Now, in what way can you say that the Bayesian model is more able to tell us what would happen if there were a change of tastes than the SRAPA model? Not at all, because you're just at a point on your production possibility curve where supplies and demands are all balanced and incomes are being spent. You're going along through time in those conditions. If there were a change in taste, let's say, then you'd be thrown on this line. There would be some expectations disappointed one way and some another. Some people are doing better than they were when they were on the equilibrium path. Others are doing worse. There must be investment and disinvestment, at least in stocks of working capital, to affect this change. So you're thrown then into a disequilibrium, short period situation, and you've got to work it all out and bring in Keynes and Kavetsky's relations to explain what's going to happen next. That it's totally idle to suppose that the Bayesian model can deal with tastes and changes in demand in any way which Strafe or von Neumann can't. And this is why I say that the theory of supply and demand markets needs a Keynesian revolution just as much as macro theory did. The destroying Say's law on the macro scheme also destroys it in the micros. And of course, anybody who knows anything about how markets do behave knows perfectly well that they don't get on. Commodity markets are continually tormented by changing expectations, and industrial production, the prices have to be set by the producer in the light of an expectation of how much he's going to be able to sell, and he sets the price accordingly. If in fact he sells more, he finds that he's making a larger net profit than he expected. He sells less, he's making a smaller net profit than he expected. He has to set his price on a guess about what is going to be, what is the appropriate price for him to set in these particular circumstances. And once you start to look at how price interaction forms, either in the supply and demand sphere, commodity markets, or in the industrial sphere, minister prices, in any case, you have to approach it in terms of a short period situation in which decisions are being taken in the light of uncertain expectations. So you have to introduce the Keynesian approach into micro theory just as much as in macro theory. Well, this is the point one. Why the neoclassical neoclassical orthodoxy, which is now being taught, is completely useless. Because it leaves out the simple fact of the difference between the moment and yesterday. Major objection, from which many minor ones follow, is that it doesn't make any statement about what sort of economy the argument is supposed to apply to. It doesn't tell you whether you're in an artisan economy, or in Robinson Crusoe, or in modern capitalism, or in the Gosplan. All the propositions are supposed to apply equally or to be quite unaffected by the nature of the economy that you're talking about. Now, this is much more true of the neoclassical scheme than it was Marshall, because Marshall was giving you a picture of the economy as he saw it, and his world is inhabited not just with individuals, but with workers, businessmen, housewives. He's discussing an actual economy and bringing in the motives and behavior of actual people. But he was not above twisting the argument to fit with his preconceived theory. He wanted to be able to say that there are economies of scale which apply to an individual firm. As a firm expands, it gets learning by doing and improves its position and trains its workers and reduces cost. But he wanted to say that in a competitive market, prices are governed by costs. So he was landed in what is known as Marshall's dilemma. Because if costs fall for the individual producer as his output expands, obviously anyone who gets a start will be able to undercut the others, expand still further, get still more economies, and so on until he's established a monopoly. And Marshall got out of this with his famous argument about how the found originator of the business, who had firmness and elasticity of character, and he makes the business grow. He's followed by his son, who is not so good, and his grandson, his grandson, and takes to academic business. So the firm can't go on growing. Well, now there's a very clear, simple objection to this, and that is that the firm can go public and become a joint stock company. And Marshall said that joint stock companies tend to stagnate. Now, this was a blatant piece of fudging the evidence to fit a preconceived theory. Now, Pigou was a very loyal and devoted follower of Marshall, and he tried to rescue Marshall from his dilemma with the idea of the equilibrium firm. You know the famous U-shaped curve, marginal curve cuts the average cost curve at its minimum. Competition will always force firms back to the equilibrium point. If they find themselves with a larger market, they produce marginal cost equal to price, making a super long profit. This attracts in competition, pushes them back, so that the only equilibrium point is at the point the minimum on the average cost curve of the individual firm. Well, this rigmarole is the only thing that has been incorporated from Marshall in modern teaching. There's a lot of ideas in Marshall which were very interesting and were very relevant to the problems of his day, despite of the way he touched it and made it all for the best of all possible worlds. But there are a number of analytical points in Marshall which are quite useful, but the only thing which has come forward to be taught to students nowadays is the U-shaped curve and equilibrium at the minimum point on the average cost curve. Now just cast your eye around the economy and see whether it's true. The joint stock companies stagnate and the firms tend to settle at a minimum size at which competition will always continue. Now, this line of thought has been introduced into modern teaching, but the main weight has been on the development of the Bayesian model. Now, in the Bayesian model, you don't have a rather unconvincing picture of an economy. You don't have any picture at all. They simply don't tell you. They start with Robinson Crusoe. They don't distinguish between an artisan economy, where the producer owns his own tools and sells his own product, and a labor and wages and profits economy. And they pretend that they could tell the people in Gosplan what they ought to do by applying the reasoning of their model. They don't tell you at all what is going on. And this mixture is then put before students. And they don't tell you when you're supposed to be in a Bayesian model and when you're supposed to be in a Pigagian model. It's all there in a kind of soup. And the link between Varas and Pigou, the Bayesian model and Pigagian model, is made simply by a pun. See, in the Bayesian system, a factor of production means something like a carpenter or a glass furnace. But in the tradition which Marshall derived from the classical economy, from Ricardo, and that was then dished up by Pigou, factors of production are land, labor, and capital. They work out your marginal products in the substitutable system of Varas, and then say, well, now, this tells us that the wages of labor are governed by the marginal product of labor. It's simply a pun. The word factor is used in both senses at once, and the two models are conflated in that way. The other major gap in the theory which follows from this failure to say what the economy is in connection with the theory of interest and profits. Keynes drew a sharp distinction between profits and interest. Interest is what a firm has to pay for borrowing finance, and profit is what it hopes to get on an investment. But you'll find in the neo-neoclassical books, interest and profits are used, rate of interest and rate of profit used more or less interchangeably. Marshall had the idea of a normal rate of profit, and Bixell has the natural rate of interest, which really means a normal rate of profit which is being earned in industry. But neither of them gives you any sort of account or any clue as to what determines it. Adam Smith had two stories. One story we have, we don't rely on the benevolence of the butcher, the baker, and the brewer to get us a dinner, but on their self-interest. It's a market in which a man, evidently with independent means, is buying from small traders. That's one story. The other story is the pin factory, where the rate of profit will be higher the lower the wages at which the workers can be got to work. These two pictures applying to two stages in the development of the economy, from the small trader and artisan to the nascent industrial capitalism. But you can't fit them together. They're two different points of view on the problem of profits, which arise in two different types of economy. Lenny Ricardo laid the foundation for a theory of profits, but this was left on one side because nobody understood it until it was disinterred by Piero Sraffa. Irving Fisher has the idea that the rate of return is the increment of income that a man can get by saving. That's true of an individual saver. You can get 10% on gilt-edged bonds, and you save out of your income. And buy the more gilt-edged bonds, you get 10% on the increment of your wealth. So that's the rate of return to the individual, that's all right. Well, then he tries to show that this accounts for the rate of profit in industry. And Marshall also, in another part of his theory, because he has many inconsistent theories, the idea that interest is the reward of waiting. And he says few would save if there were no interest. So he muddles you up between a return on the total wealth you've got already and the addition to your unearned income, which you're going to get by saving and adding to it. This notion is still knocking about in the theory. It's very vague and inconsistent, but the idea that the rate of interest is somehow to be accounted for by the impatience of a householder to consume all his money, he won't consume all his income, he won't save unless he gets interest. Now, we don't know, we haven't the smallest idea what saving would be if there weren't interest. Because in the world we live in, firms can make profits if they borrow finance, so they're prepared to pay interest on what they borrow. And the rate of interest is positive because the rate of profit is positive. And then the householder can get the benefit of this by saving and adding to his unearned income. This is quite obvious. If you had a world in which there was no profit, you have a pure loan economy. You can make up a model. Samuelson made that once, said he got it wrong. You make up a model of a pure saving economy. Well, then, obviously, if there is lending and borrowing in this economy, you will have a balance between those people who are prudent, want to carry purchasing power to the future, say for their own age, and those who are impatient. And whether the rate of interest is positive or negative will just depend on whether impatience happens to outweigh prudence or vice versa. In fact, I think, judging by how people actually behave, you'd expect prudence to predominate and the rate of interest to be negative. It's more important for you to have some money for your old age than it is to have an extra spree while you're young. Well, this idea of the rate of return on saving can be transferred to the idea of rate of return on investment if you look at it in terms of an economy, say, of artisans. Say the blacksmith is selling horseshoes, and if he puts part of his labor and materials into improving his forge, then during that time he can sell less horseshoes, so he's reducing his consumption in order to increase his means of production and have higher productivity in the future. In the book I use the example of the kibbutz. You have a group of people who have certain resources, and they have to decide, whether by a committee or a vote or however it is, they decide what part of their resources to use for earning for current consumption and what part they'll put in, say, draining the marsh to increase their productive capacity in the future. But this idea of a return, I'm saving as a sacrifice and so on, this makes sense if you put it in that kind of economy. But it hasn't any relation whatever to the rate of profit on capital in the capitalist economy. It's the return for an increment to society as a whole, whereas the rate of profit is the rate of profit to the capitalists on the whole of the wealth which they've committed to production. But there's absolutely no relation at all between this rate of return and the rate of profit. Just by purely verbal jugglery, they get you into thinking that they have got a theory of profits, but they haven't at all. Let's go back to this Lorenzian economy a la Harry Johnson. Now, as you can compare two economies, one has a larger number party than the other. That's to say, it has more of some inputs and not less of any other inputs. So it could be represented by a larger number party. So then Johnson would say that in the second economy, you will have a lower car price for putty and a higher rail wage. And you can work that out and fill in all the details. All right. Well, there's been a tremendous amount of fuss and argument about this question of what do you mean by a quantity of capital? Obviously, just comparing two lumps of putty is a very primitive way of dealing with the problem. But you could, if you like, make a list. There are so and so many available inputs in this list, and so and so many available inputs in that list, and then compare them as to lists of means of production. But how would you be able to say that the one with the larger amount of inputs has a lower rate of profit? What is it that they expect you to deduce from this argument? See, all this fuss about measuring capital is really